The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
She's got the news. She talks with newsmakers. She encourages us to laugh, and she cries with us. Speaking truth to power and questioning authority daily, it's the Nicole Sandler Show.
We've seen gas bags and grifters, con men and drifters, junior and feckless, and many truth shifters. But do you recall the most odious flunky of all? Rudolph the former mayor, did you better carve his nose? 'Cause if you heard him lately, you would have to say it grows. All of the morons, Hitchmen, like to lie and play his game. They couldn't care that Rudy would be left to take the blame. Then one foggy vote night eve, Rudolph came to say, Dominion, your machines ain't right, so I'll slander you tonight. Oh, how Dominion hates him, as they shouted out, we'll sue. Rudolph, the former mayor, really never had a clue. Rudolph, the former mayor, didn't know what to do. And when he asked the moron, the moron shouted, who are you? All of the other scumbags who promoted Rudy's lie now find they're in big trouble, including Davy's pillow guy. Then one humbling DC night, Sid Powell came to say, Rudolph, this was not so bright, I'm being sued both left and right. Oh, how the world keeps watching as he ponders what will be. Rudolph, the former mayor, will go down in infamy. Rudolph, the former mayor, will go down in infamy.
The Parody Project, getting us started this Tuesday edition of the Nicole Sandler Show. Welcome to it. That's Don Caron, the Parody Project. You know, it is the season, so I thought we'd start with a little holiday music. Rudolph, the former mayor. So hold on. I've got C-SPAN up here. Hold on. Let's see where we are. The House, I believe, is in the middle of the vote to hold Mark Meadows in contempt of Congress. So last night, I hope you saw this because it was quite brilliant. I was expecting the January 6th committee was just going to, you know, do the quick vote to hold him in contempt, sort of like they did with Bannon, if I recall correctly. I mean, there's been a lot of stuff that I've watched since then, but I thought it was just like a 5-minute thing. Boom, they hold him in contempt. Okay, they're going to send it to the full House. And on they go. That's not what happened last night at all. Each of the 9 members of the committee got to speak. You know, I think they call it a debate in the House. It wasn't actually a debate, but they laid out new evidence, new information. Because before Mark Meadows decided he wasn't going to cooperate with the January 6th committee, he said he was. And he gave them somewhere on the order of 9,000. Yes?
They're not voting.
They're not voting. Come here, quickly. Pick up the microphone because, you know, hear you across the room. I hear you. They don't.
They're not currently voting.
Yeah.
What happened is Evidently, Steny Hoyer hurt the feelings of one of the Republican douchebags.
That's what it says. Republicans took offense to Majority Leader Hoyer's remarks during debate on the Meadows contempt resolution. Was that when he talked about Benghazi?
No.
The House is working on legislation to hold the
guy from Indiana, I can't remember his name, Burns or whatever, who was supposed to be on the bipartisan committee.
Right.
But then they all voted against it.
Yes.
So that jackass, he basically said, well, you know, this guy wanted a bipartisan committee, but then he voted against it, well, you know, like all these other fuckwits.
Right.
So,
oh, no.
So he hurt his feelings.
Oh, no.
The poor guy.
Uh-oh. Something happened with my YouTube feed. I don't know what, but something. It looks like YouTube's not feeding. Hold on. I'm working on it. It's one of those things. YouTube says it's streaming. I don't know what happened to YouTube. You hear voices. You can hear us, right? You just can't see us. What the hell, YouTube? YouTube says it's streaming. Hold on. I'm going to try one other thing. Sorry. I know this is wonderful radio, but bear with me. I'm going to stop. No, if I stop the YouTube, it won't start again. An error occurred. Learn more. I don't know why. So the House is on, I guess they're on hold while they try to get over their hurt feelings. I don't know why YouTube is not working. You guys, there it is. It's back. I hope it's back for you too. Okay. Hi, YouTube. Somehow we got it fixed. Go figure. The gremlins have taken over my studio. All right. So that's what's going on. We got the scoop from David. I will monitor, C-SPAN. Oh, here's what Steny Hoyer said, I guess, that pissed them off.
Accountable. An administration with whom he did not agree and thought was not doing the right thing.
Uh-huh.
And he issued subpoena after subpoena after subpoena.
Yeah. Yeah. And? They were talking about Benghazi.
The reason I say every one of us ought to vote for this is because this institution needs this power.
Okay. Yeah, they do, to hold someone in contempt, I guess. Steny Hoyer seems to be at a loss for words here.
This institution is charged under the Constitution with protecting.
Okay, we're not going to go through this. We'll figure out later what happened. In fact, in just a couple of minutes, I'm going to call Lisa Graves, who you should know. Lisa Graves is my go-to person for all things legal. These days, she's the president of True North Research. She was the executive director of the Center for Media and Democracy, and that's where she investigated and reported on the Koch brothers and Alec and that whole skeezy world. Lisa Graves also served her time in the government, too. She was the chief counsel for nominations on the Senate Judiciary Committee under Patrick Leahy. She was also deputy assistant attorney general in the U.S. Department of Justice during the Clinton administration under Janet Reno, so she's got the bona fides. But before I get Lisa on the line, I want to share with you what I thought was the most amazing moment of last night's the vote to hold Mark Meadows in contempt out of the select committee before it went to the full House, which is where it's hung up right now. So Liz Cheney, decided to read some of the tweets that she got, that the committee got, when Mark Meadows volunteered to turn over some 9,000 pages of documents before he declared executive privilege, which is bullshit anyway. So here's... This is Steny Hoyer still speaking. Hold on. It's Steny Hoyer still going on about Benghazi, and that's what I heard before. That's what I thought they took offense with, but whatever. Those Republicans, they'll get offended by anything. So anyway, as I was saying, Liz Cheney, take it away.
Multiple Fox News hosts knew the president needed to act immediately.
Uh-oh.
They texted Mr. Meadows. And he has turned over those texts.
And in case you're wondering, okay, because I joined this obviously in mid-thought, they're talking about what happened on January 6th when members of Congress, members of the press, people who were in the Capitol were texting Mark Meadows furiously saying, Donald Trump Jr., Fox News, I say that with disdain, hosts, texting Mark Meadows saying, do something. That's what Liz Cheney is talking about now.
Quote, Mark, the president needs to tell people in the Capitol to go home. This is hurting all of us. He is destroying his legacy, Laura Ingraham wrote. Please get him on TV, destroying everything you have accomplished, Brian Kilmeade texted. Quote, can he make a statement? Ask people to leave the Capitol, Sean Hannity urged. As the violence continued, one of the president's sons texted Mr. Meadows, quote, he's got to condemn this shit ASAP. The Capitol Police tweet is not enough, Donald Trump Jr. texted. Meadows responded, quote, I'm pushing it hard. I agree. Still, President Trump did not immediately act.
Yeah.
Donald Trump Jr. texted.
Donald Trump Jr. texted.
And again.
Again and again.
Urging action by the president. Quote, we need an Oval Office address. He has to lead now. It has gone too far and gotten out of hand. End quote. But hours passed without necessary action by the president.
Yeah. So that was the moment I all of a sudden turned all my attention to the television. It was on in the background last night, but I, you know, was doing other things. But I heard those texts being read, and it's like, okay, that deserves our full attention. And so it was. And now it's held up. The vote by the full House is being held up because, because I guess the Republicans were offended by something that Steny Hoyer said. Oh, no. All right. So let's get Lisa Graves on the line. And for those of you on YouTube, I am so sorry. We are having YouTube gremlin issues today. I keep refreshing. But when I do, so when I refresh the page, it comes back, but then it goes out again. There's something funky going on with YouTube today. I do believe we're streaming on Twitter, if it's working, and Twitch and Facebook. But again, we're probably having the same issues. I apologize. You can also listen to the audio stream at NicoleSandlerStream.com. That's the easiest. There's also some audio streams available at NicoleSandler.com on the Listen Live page. Ah, just one of those days, isn't it? All right, let's get Lisa Graves on the line, and hopefully she will pick up. Oop, let me turn that down, because that's kind of loud in our ears, isn't it? So calling Lisa Graves, and...
Hi, it's Lisa Graves.
Hey, Lisa Graves, it's Nicole Sandler calling.
Hi, Nicole, how are you?
I'm okay, how are you?
Good. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, thank you for being here. So, Lisa, there's so much going on that that I wanted to get your thoughts on. So, I appreciate you being available. The first thing, obviously, is the news that broke last night when the Select Committee in the House voted to hold Mark Meadows in contempt of Congress for refusing to cooperate with the committee and comply with the subpoena. So, in your role, you as a former Deputy Assistant Attorney General, what power does Congress have to compel people to testify? And when they don't show up, what recourse do they have?
Well, you know, for many, many years, it was almost unquestioned that Congress had the power to compel witnesses to testify and that they could hold them in contempt if they didn't testify. And people would come, you know, that they didn't want to testify, and they would take the fifth. We saw that happen with people like Oliver North and others. Mm-hmm. And, you know, only in the past few years have we seen this absolute recalcitrance by anyone connected with Trump, other than, I suppose, his former attorney, Mr. Cohen,
right,
to actually come before Congress and testify under oath, meaning subject to the penalty of perjury, before Congress about nearly anything, and in particular about Trump's efforts to subvert our democracy and to literally steal the election by claiming the election was stolen, falsely claiming the election was stolen. And so there's been obviously litigation in recent years around Congress's impeachment efforts, and there's been just absolute disrespect, in fact, contempt for the rule of law by numerous people who have worked with Trump, who were appointed or hired by Trump. And this is just the latest episode of someone who clearly should come before Congress, has been subpoenaed to come before Congress, has been subpoenaed to cooperate, who refuses to cooperate, perhaps based on threats by Trump against him.
Right.
But nevertheless, someone who has vital information that the public has a right to know, that Congress has a right to investigate, and who is thumbing his nose at the law. And I hope he's held in contempt. And I hope, in the words of, you know, Trump's fans, that he's locked up.
Right.
Lock him up, because this is another Trumpster who has utter contempt for the rule of law and for the role of our co-equal branches of government, including specifically Congress, a body that he was once a member of. And so it's particularly horrifying for him to act with such contempt. But I think, you know, the committee was right to hold him in contempt, and he should be held in contempt, and there should be serious consequences for his contempt of Congress.
Right. Well, it looks like the House might be back now. Did you? No, they're still. Do you know what's going on right now? They were voting in the full House, right? And then the Republicans objected to Steny Hoyer's remarks about something. And so there's a holdup. They're not voting right now.
Right. So we're waiting for that vote to proceed. And, you know, this is another delay tactic by Trump's party, or, you know, the Republican Party, which really should be called Trump's party at this point. We'll see what happens, but I am hopeful that there will be a majority vote that holds Mark Meadows in contempt. He certainly is in contempt. Hopefully that vote will happen later today. And I hope that there are serious consequences for him. And I hope that sends a message to the other people who are hiding behind Trump's skirts and following Trump's orders and demands, and, that they will, understand that there will be consequences for them refusing to comply with requests for information from Congress.
But Lisa, will there be? See, this is my question. So if somebody refuses to comply with a subpoena for a criminal court hearing, they don't show up, don't they immediately send the police out to arrest this person, to find them and bring them in?
Well, not necessarily immediately, although it depends on what the judge orders, in essence.
Okay.
If it's immediate or, you know, at a certain time. But it is, in fact, the case that in litigation before the judicial branch, has the power to find someone in contempt, either in person or in their absence, and to basically approve, in essence, a warrant for their arrest. And,
right.
You know, Congress has long had the power to call people to testify. You know, it's behaved in some ways in a sort of weakened way over the past several years, where it requests people to testify, you know, which it certainly doesn't have to use the power of subpoena. It can ask people to testify without being compelled to testify. And so it has done so. But the fact is that, you know, until these recent years, you know, there was really no notion that it would be acceptable for someone in the executive branch, an official executive branch, to refuse to testify. I mean, I guess, you know, it's the case that someone can say that they don't want to testify, but they have to show up and take the Fifth Amendment and say that they can't testify for fear of, you know, they don't want to be compelled to give evidence against themselves that may incriminate themselves. They need to come, show up, and then take the consequences, either take the Fifth or be held in contempt.
Right. But so there used to be something, though, called inherent contempt, where if somebody didn't show up to comply with a subpoena, they could send the sergeant at arms out and arrest them. But the reason they're giving for not utilizing that now is because it hasn't been used in 100 years. Well, isn't something there to be used when it's needed? And if it hasn't been needed in 100 years, oh, well, it is now. Because here's the problem to me. This takes so long. Last night, the committee holds him in contempt. Today, the full House votes on it. Then they refer it, if they all vote yes, they refer it to the Justice Department, who then has to bring it before a grand jury who decides if there's going to be an indictment. But before anything happens, look, Steve Bannon's not going to come to court until, what is it, July now? You know, if Mark Meadows, if this goes through the whole process, we'll be lucky if his court date is before Election Day.
Yeah, I mean, I personally don't think Congress should be sort of exceeding that kind of power to the Justice Department, to the executive branch. They're only lucky in this moment to have an executive branch mm-hmm. that has a leader who's Democratic. Obviously, when Trump was in the White House and was trying to micromanage the Justice Department and dictate that it basically serve his political agenda, there was no chance that that Justice Department was going to act fairly and enforce Congress's requests against the request of the president. In fact, we saw evidence upon evidence of Barr's efforts to basically spin things or, you know, stand in the way of things until he finally, you know, couldn't accede or wouldn't accede to Trump's ultimate request to basically help throw out the election. But everything up to that point, Barr was aiding Trump with. And so I don't think it's appropriate for an independent branch of the government like Congress to defer these things to the executive branch when the executive branch is in some ways, you know, the most political in a sense, in terms of having one person like Trump who would violate all the norms about you know, the separation between the Justice Department and prosecutorial decisions and the White House. He clearly had total disrespect for that principle that had been in place, you know, since post-Nixon. So I don't think that's appropriate. I definitely understand what you're saying, that historically Congress has not utilized the power of its sergeant of arms to take people into custody or to arrest them. That hasn't happened in, you know, a number of decades, although there's certainly historical precedent for it. You know, and I suppose now the issue is, like, what is the mechanism for doing so since they haven't done so? Like, would they jail them themselves, et cetera? And I hear you completely on this, like, the time delay of doing it this way, where, you know, then someone like Bannon, who's clearly acted in contempt, it's pretty unequivocal that he's violated this norm, that he's violated the subpoena, that he's refused to comply. And I think justice should move, you know, the wheels of justice should move more swiftly. There's no reason for it to take this long or to take 6 months or more for someone like Bannon to be penalized. It should be much quicker. And, you know, these delay tactics are on the side, you know, in essence, in aid of Trump's agenda to continue to lie to the American people, to continue to, you know, push, you know, his lies and try to somehow, you know, maneuver his way into power, in essence, through the capture of the House of Representatives and the Senate in the election next year. So I think things should move more quickly. I think Congress should take a much more robust view of its co-equal power as a co-equal branch. So I'm with you, Nicole.
Yeah, because here's the other thing. I'm thinking, you know, the legislative branch, that would be Congress, is charged with oversight of the executive, right? There's a system that I learned about in, you know, eighth grade of checks and balances. However, it seems that the legislative branch, their enforcement teeth are missing. Have they just, like, atrophied out of old age or something? They have no method to enforce the rules or their enforcement or their oversight of anything, it seems. We need to fix that. Obviously, it's not going to be fixed with Republicans in Congress, but I just find it astounding that we're in this position where Congress is essentially toothless.
Well, you know, right after the election in 2016, I gave an interview with NPR, and they asked me about kind of what was coming. And I said, you know, the rule of law in America seems to be such a fixed concept. But in fact, you know, it's a very thin reed because it depends upon the willingness of people in positions of power to follow the law.
Right.
You know, in theory, we have this great system of checks and balances. But in reality, it's dependent upon people respecting that they're stewards of this government, that they're not sort of the last emperor, the last king, or the first king, as Trump seems to want to be in his own little Caesar-like, you know, ambitions.
Yep.
But that these members of Congress, that the people in the executive branch are stewards of our republic, of our system of democracy, and that they will follow the rules, that they'll follow the law. And so You know, we don't have adequate checks on the executive branch.
Nope.
Plainly, what we've seen from this past 4 years or 5 years now is in some ways how weak Congress is in its ability to deal with a recalcitrant, in fact, lawless or, you know, law disregarding law, someone who's has contempt of the law, like Trump and
right.
many of Trump's closest advisors, like the guy at the Justice Department who was, you know, trying to maneuver his way to help Trump overthrow the election results in state after state, and many more, you know, examples of this this behavior, the type of people he put in a positions of power who, you know, shouldn't be trusted with any power.
Anything.
They shouldn't be the people in charge of a crosswalk.
That's right.
You know, let alone whole agencies of our government. And so, you know, I'm saddened by Congress sort of losing so much power vis-a-vis the executive branch. I'm sad to see this rise since Nixon, you know, really Nixon, then, you know, some of Reagan's actions, you know, with Iran-Contra, you know, some of the Bush-Cheney actions during the, you know, George W. Bush's term, and then Trump's term, this executive branch that has taken on so much power to itself and has acted with, you know, over time, this trend toward, you know, not being respectful of its of the legislative branch, you know, and so I think it's a huge problem. I think Congress needs to really be more assertive in its power. But unfortunately, the other dynamic, which I think we'll probably talk about a bit, is how Trump's people have captured the courts. How the people who were handpicked by Leonard Leo, whose operations were funded in part by Charles Koch, one of the richest people in the world,
mm-hmm.
And other secretive billionaires to capture the courts. How now we have a federal court system that has been captured by some people who have are trying to redefine our Constitution into what they call the quote structural Constitution, which is a completely made up term to claim that, you know, Congress doesn't actually have that much power compared to the executive branch. And that the executive branch has, you know, enormous powers that Congress can't check, which I think is an outrageous distortion of our Constitution.
Without a doubt. And that's something that was pushed under W, right? The unitary executive. And I remember how we bristled at that. And it seems like this is that to the next level.
On steroids. And potentially with the backing up of a narrow, extremely partisan majority of the U.S. Supreme Court, a majority that was, you know, technically picked
stolen.
By Trump, but really handpicked by Leonard Leo, doing the bidding of his personal agenda to, you know, dramatically roll back legal precedents, including precedents about the power of our independent agencies, the powers of Congress over those agencies, and more. And so, you know, we really are at a notwithstanding the fact that Trump is no longer in power, his tentacles continue to reach out and distort and corrupt our political process, distort the people's perception of reality, you know, with the aiding and abetting of Fox News and OAN and other, you know, sites that are basically extreme partisan tools that mm-hmm. are advancing you know, some of the most outrageous claims I think ever made, certainly in my lifetime, like this idea that Hungary is a model for America. You know, it's just extraordinary the kind of deceptive claims and nonsense we're seeing pushed by Tucker Carlson to aid Trump, and, you know, all the people sucking up over at OAN to mm-hmm. aid Trump, and all these politicians, quite frankly, on the right wing side, who have in essence given up any real allegiance to American democracy in favor of this, in my personal view, monstrous person in the form of Trump, who
right.
Has absolute and total disregard for the actual integrity of our election system and is willing to smear it and lie about it and twist people's arms and try to corrupt our system in order to steal the election while claiming that he's trying to, quote, stop the steal.
Right.
In the words of Roger Stone, who's also one of the most venal and corrupt people who's ever been connected with, you know, any American leader in U.S. history, in my view.
Yes. So, Lisa Graves, let me ask you this. You know, there was a saying that was popular during the Obama years, but I think it was misplaced there because it's more applicable now. I'm talking about the fierce urgency of now. I mean, things right now are so tenuous. I and I'm not the only one saying this. Our very democracy is on the brink. Does this administration, do the Democrats in charge, ostensibly, does Merrick Garland understand the fierce urgency of the moment we are at in history? And are they doing enough?
Well, I don't know Judge Garland or Attorney General Garland myself, and so I don't know what he or anyone else is thinking in terms of that sense of the fierce urgency of now. But, you know, I have tremendous respect for his legacy as a judge. He was well regarded as a sort of nonpartisan, independent, fair-minded judge, and I wish that he was on the Supreme Court. But I don't know that you need a judge in charge of the Justice Department.
No, you need a bulldog. You know,
I think you need someone like a Senator Whitehouse, someone who is understands fully the state our democracy is in and is willing to use the appropriate powers of the Justice Department to defend our democracy from this, you know, really unprecedented assault that the Trumpsters are orchestrating. I do want to give credit, though, because it is obviously the case that that Judge Garland's the Justice Department under Judge Garland has recently sued Texas for its efforts to further advance minority rule and disenfranchise voters.
That just happened. They sued them over their the districting. That they're trying to
redistricting. And so basically this idea that people, that the electors choose the voters rather than the voters really choosing the electors in terms of how these maps are drawn. And so I want to give credit for that. But I personally have great respect for him and I'm sure for many of the people who serve with him. But I think, you know, it's sort of like it's a correction to correct the Justice Department from being so far to the right to put someone in who's has spent nearly 20 years on the bench as a neutral judge.
Right.
It's not that I want the Justice Department not to be neutral, but I want the Justice Department, and I don't want the department to be politicized in the way that the Trumpsters did, but I want it to be aggressive in protecting our rights, aggressive, appropriately assertive in countering this orchestrated campaign to disenfranchise people and more, the things that these campaign officials are doing in these states, these Republicans are doing to try to rewrite all the rules so that they can set aside the popular will in states. For example, the efforts in Arizona by Arizona Republicans, not just the completely outlandish and ridiculous hiring of some, fly-by-night operation to conduct, a quote review.
Come on, the cyber ninjas you're calling fly-by-night? Well, you know.
this totally ridiculous. Like, it's almost the equivalent of Giuliani's
Four Seasons landscape.
You shouldn't be hiring these completely unknown outsiders, to be looking at the ballots. And
that's
obviously
right.
The consequences and the election machines, the consequences are they've got to throw out all those machines and have new ones because of the potential for corruption by these unknown individuals who were tasked with without any, in my view, any really valid basis for outsourcing this to some, random group that had a biased, a biased view to begin with, a view that was not grounded, in my view, in actual reality based on the actual audits that had occurred.
Right.
So you have these state election officials who are just willing to, unfortunately, really grossly distort the rules of our elections in order to basically advance the power of Trump and with it their own power. And I'm just astonished. As much as I've seen the Republican Party, you know, engage in some real egregious activities over the years, this, you know, turn toward Trump, the doubling down of him even after his role in inciting the riot on January 6th, his role, which is manifest now in the PowerPoint, you know, that we know of in terms of trying to literally steal this election.
Yeah.
There's just no shame. The idea that so many of these Republicans would be willing to do his bidding in ways to advance his effort to steal that election and steal future elections is just so grotesque and repulsive. I barely have words to describe it.
No, you and me both. And the fact that, you know, I say half the country, I know it's not half the country, but that so many people, 74 million Americans voted for that man, and something like 60 some odd percent of the Republican Party believes that the election was stolen from him. The gaslighting of America is astounding. The fact that so many people are so easily led by an obvious con man is not only astounding, it's depressing. And that's what frightens me, that these people are holding on to his lies that are so blatant, but they're believing them. And that they're like, and then you've got the, you know, the right wing media echo chamber, which to me is propaganda, which shouldn't be legal. But they are repeating the lies. Do you know that it took until the middle of the day today before Fox ever even alluded to what happened last night and the texts that came to Mark Meadows from some people who worked at Fox and, you know, Donald Jr. They ignored it so that those millions of people who get their so-called news, get their information exclusively from these propaganda outlets, had no idea that happened last night.
I mean, it's astonishing because some of the same people who are in that audience considered a progressive to be sheep. Which is actually pretty absurd, or snowflakes, you know, whatever they want to do when they claim they're trying to own the libs or whatever sort of aspersions they're trying to cast.
Right.
But the reality is that they've been spoon-fed this diet of just crap, pardon me, from Tucker and other Fox hosts. And like you said, they aren't even actually covering what's really happening, or their role, or even their efforts to try to intervene with Mark Meadows. So they're hiding information from their audience on a regular basis. They're distorting them. They're trying to keep them angry about, you know, other issues to distract them. They're, you know, hyping things like Fox is I think a real poisonous influence on our democracy. And it was created that way by its founders, by the men who concocted it. And
Absolutely.
It has really tried to normalize Trump's lies as if they're true and rationalize them and spin for him and attack Biden just incessantly. You know, it's just extraordinary that this type of propaganda effort, you know, is so well funded and, you know, has so many advertisers and so many followers. But I guess the other part that really does astonish me, and I am with you, like, it is, I suppose it's a little bit like that, you know, there's that image where you look at it and at one hand it's like a young woman, and then if you look a different way
it's an old man. Right.
But once you see the other image, you can't sort of unsee it.
Right.
And I feel like it's like that with Trump. Like, he's so obviously a con man, and everyone who can see that he's a con man, like, it's just so blatant and out there in so many ways, with so much evidence over the years of his behavior, including his behavior in the White House.
Yep.
And yet the people who don't claim to not see it or not care, I guess there's two camps. The people who don't see it, who just think that he's like the greatest president ever somehow. I mean, that's so an astonishing thing. Yes. because he speaks to their bias.
Because he sounds like a fifth grader. As somebody who never made it out of the elementary school. And the thing is, these people who idolize him, he would, you know, to quote Monty Python, spit in their general direction. He has no allegiance to them. He thinks they're disgusting. Those are not people he would hang out with.
I mean, what really, I think one of the things in observing Trump over these past few years that was really has really been sort of shocking in its capacity for manipulation is his effort to tell them that any attack on him is an attack on them.
Right.
Any criticism of him is an attack. So like this, his effort to bond with them, to claim that he's their, he's their vanguard, that he's the man defending them when he's the guy who pushed through this gigantic tax cut for billionaires.
Right.
That, you know, really has screwed over ordinary people and basically made it harder, although not impossible, but harder, harder to pass, you know, meaningful changes, governmental policies that would help ordinary people's lives, because now they say they can't afford it since they, you know, we don't have enough revenue because we gave big tax cuts to people like Charles Koch and his kids and other billionaires, buddies of Trump, you know. And so the idea that they can sustain this fiction that Trump is on their side when in fact he's really screwed them over on public policy. And in fact, you know, he's, you know, there's all this upset over the delays at the port in Los Angeles, which began under Trump. But, you know, there's no accountability for Trump's, you know, role. And the reality probably is ultimately of that, it's not Biden or Trump. It's
right.
Just that we were in a pandemic. And it's, you know, it's been a real challenge for the whole world to deal with, you know, shipping and transit and everything else. But
right.
Like this idea that it's all Biden's fault or that it's Biden's
inflation.
Fault for gas prices,
inflation.
It's ridiculous.
Inflation is a global problem. It's not just here. It sucks. But it's not.
Yep.
You would think if you listen to them that this is something only happening in the United States, that inflation and gas prices are rising. This is happening around the world because we're in the middle of a global pandemic. It is astounding. And by the way, I need to correct myself. Monty Python didn't say I'll spit in your general direction. They said I'll fart in your general direction. But it was the Black Knight who said, come back here. I'll spit on you. Sorry, I conflated the two.
I didn't want to say that F word.
You can. And I fart in their general direction all the time. All the time.
But I was going to say, you know, that's another part of that Fox disinformation thing is they're not telling people what's happening globally on inflation or the economy. But the other part of the Fox disinformation, which was really insidious, and it seems quaint, I suppose now, is this idea that only under Trump was the stock market doing well.
Right.
You look at the actual trend line, you know, from the Obama administration after they, you know, turned things around after the economy crashed during the Bush administration, it's just been a mostly upward line. And so Trump, you know, it was just that Fox wasn't telling its viewers how great what the Wall Street economy was doing under Obama. They only started trumpeting the economy with Trump, and then Trump could lie to them and say, this is all me, when it was actually just, you know, a trend line on a chart.
Right.
It had nothing to do with him.
Right. Right.
Yeah. I mean, there's certainly some businesses that, you know, that were very excited about Trump, like oil barons and coal barons, because he was trying to stop any reasonable regulation of them. But for the most part, you know, it's not like the economy thrived because of Trump. The economy was on an upward trajectory until the pandemic. And then it's been struggling, like you said, worldwide. And the other thing that, you know, there's been tremendously potent studies that have come out in recent weeks that have talked about how, you know, it's not other than the gas prices, which are beyond, you know, almost any president's control in reality.
Right.
But beyond that, that what's really happening to prices is that CEO profits, you know, CEO pay and bonuses and payouts to shareholders are on the rise. And so they're increasing the price of goods for
right,
us.
Right, of course.
You know, it's not that things cost more. It's that that these CEOs and the shareholders who they want to benefit are basically gouging us. And that's not something the president is causing. That's caused by the greed of the class of CEOs that are basically in Trump's, you know, fanbook.
You know what? I hate to say it. This is, and this is off subject, but I got to say, we watched a Shark Tank the other night, and some person came up there with their product, and they were so proud of themselves that it cost them $3.50 to manufacture out the door, as they say, and their cost, their charge, their retail price is $35. That right there is the problem. Make a profit. You know, you deserve it. It used to be a 50% markup. So make it $7, but 35, 10%, that's the problem. Everybody's charging whatever they can gouge the public for without any consideration being paid to what it costs average Americans. There's something that I retweeted today. I don't know if it was on Twitter or if it was, I think it was on Twitter. Let me find this because, and I didn't check the accuracy, but I think it's real. It says the wealth of Elon Musk in 2011 was $2 billion. In 2021, $265.4 billion. Wealth of Jeff Bezos in 2011, $18 billion. In 2021, it's $198 billion. Mark Zuckerberg, 2011, $17.5 billion. In 2021, $118.9 billion. U.S. minimum wage, 2011, $7.25. 2021, $7.25.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the figures are just jaw-dropping. And the lack of accountability, the inability to have Congress pass or repeal or, you know, claw back these massive benefits to people like Elon Musk who are not paying their fair share at all by any definition is just, you know, it's just extraordinary to me that that's not, you know, if Fox actually cared about the people who are its watchers, its, you know, viewers, it would be talking about that. But it, of course, doesn't. And Trump doesn't. You know, they want to blame everyone else. But the fact is that these billionaires are not paying anywhere near their fair share, and they certainly could. And, you know, and this is a problem in many ways. Mm-hmm. That minimum wage, the minimum wage is so outrageously low that it's horribly shocking. And there's another minimum wage. It's the sub minimum wage for people who wait tables or are tips workers.
That's right.
And when I was waiting tables in 1990, it was $2.01 an hour that you were
paid. And now it's about the same. Isn't it?
Now it's like $2.15 or $2.20.
That's for tipped workers because they say, well, you get paid in tips. You don't need my salary. That is
bullshit.
Bullshit.
I mean, yeah, I mean, that amount, if you figure out what that is, that you know, $2, like, let's assume, but let's just even assume it's, you know, 7.25, or let's just call it
even
eight.
Then, right?
You know, that's like $64 a day.
Yeah.
That's, you know, that's like $300 a week. That's $1,200 a month. And that's before your Social Security or other kind of baseline payroll tax.
Right. Yep.
Yeah, it's like, and you just cannot live on $1,000 a month in almost any actual city in America. Maybe some rural areas, theoretically, you might be able to find an apartment to share for $300 or something, but it's just not, it's not real. And then you have these businesses in America, these franchises who, in the Franchise Association, has been one of the biggest attackers, along with the National Restaurant Association, raising the minimum wage, or Chamber of Commerce. But the fact is, you have this franchise industry that's built on basically having people work the minimum wage possible, like $7.25 an hour, and then the intermediate owner, the franchiser, makes money off it. But the franchise, the ultimate franchise, like Subway or whatever, like, they're making huge bucks because they're paying people so little. It's built on ripping people off and taking advantage of people who, you know, think that they don't have any other choices or to starve.
I know.
Our market.
It's horrible.
It's just astonishing.
It is astonishing. Yep. And the balance of power has been, you know, tilted in the wrong direction for so long. And frankly, we see no relief in sight because of the way the Republicans are. And accusing us of stealing everything while they're stealing everything. It's the gaslighting of America going on at the same time. Lisa Graves, while I have you here, I've got to ask you about another big legal precedent, I think, that was set. So last week, the Supreme Court weighed in on the Texas abortion law and said, well, we're not going to stop the abortion providers from suing over this law, from challenging the law. We're going to let those suits go forward to an extent. Only some people they can sue, others they can't. But we'll let it go forward in an amended way. In the meantime, we're going to let the law stand and continue so that if you are pregnant beyond 6 weeks, you cannot get an abortion in the state of Texas, which I found totally astounding, because the whole vigilante aspect of this so-called law is unconstitutional. And the fact they're letting it go, I find it incredible. But Gavin Newsom of California this week decided to take advantage of that and say, well, if that's the way they want to do it, then we're going to utilize the same basic law and say that anybody can sue any manufacturer or distributor of assault weapons or ghost gun parts or plans or kits in the state of California. And then, I don't know if you heard it, but Tish James, the Attorney General of New York, was on The View today. And let me just play the clip when she was asked about it.
California Governor Newsom wants to take that law and flip it and allow citizens in his state to sue assault weapon and ghost gun providers. Now, would you do something like this? Is it an effective legal strategy?
In New York.
The answer is yes. When I heard about that, I said to my team, we need to follow his lead. Mm-hmm. And the reason why that is because gun manufacturers and gun distributors in this country are immunized. No liability whatsoever. Uh-huh. They're the only industry that is protected in this country. And given the carnage and given the fact that this is the 9th anniversary of Sandy Hook,
I am today
sick and tired of prayers. And individuals whose hearts go out to all of those who have lost lives. Mm-hmm. We can do something about it. Sin. And what we need to do is hold these gun manufacturers and these gun distributors liable.
Okay, so Lisa Graves, it continues, but you get the gist of it. She's saying, what do you think about this?
Well, you know, I think that she's right. I think that there ought to be liability for those, you know, gun sellers, gun manufacturers who are manufacturing these assault weapons that are rapid firing weapons, mm-hmm. that are designed to murder people. They're not designed to hunt deer or quail or anything like that. They're literally designed to murder human beings and to murder as many human beings as possible, as quickly as possible. That's why they're rapid firing, you know, high velocity, high caliber, weapons. I think that in some ways the issues are distinct between what's happening in Texas and what's happening in California, other states.
Oh,
I think it's long overdue for there to be liability for gun dealers and gun manufacturers for selling weapons that are inherently dangerous and are in fact designed to murder human beings. I think that was an issue that came up in the 90s after Columbine, and there was an effort to try to apply the lessons from the tobacco litigation, the liability for, you know, an industry that was causing dramatic harm to so many people's lives through cancer caused by tobacco, and to apply that to the gun industry. And the gun industry sort of was able to fend off that effort to hold them accountable back then with the help of groups like the American Legislative Exchange Council, the Koch-funded ALEC. But, you know, then what they did was go to work to try to get Bush into office and take over the Supreme Court. And after 2005, after the two appointments that in 2005 and 2006 by George W. Bush, that's John Roberts and Samuel Alito, they basically revisited precedent that was, you know, more than 100 years old to say that there was, quote, an individual right to bear arms in the Second Amendment versus a collective right to have a well-regulated militia.
Right.
And with that decision, they made it harder to, harder to hold people accountable for the guns, or to regulate how people own guns. But I still think it's possible to do so. I think it's possible to hold gun manufacturers accountable, and I embrace creative ways to use the law properly to do so. The Texas case, for me, the vigilante component, in the sense of women who have a current constitutional right to their reproductive autonomy, to have, you know, strangers try to stop them from accessing reproductive health services, from accessing abortion, is really something that's extraordinary and is unprecedented. What's unprecedented to me, sorry to go on about this, Nicole,
but
what's unprecedented to me about what we're seeing with that decision last week, and I think Justice Sotomayor spoke to this, was that, ordinarily for a stay, meaning to hold a law so it's not enforced, what you need to show is irreparable harm and a likelihood of success,
mm-hmm.
that you're likely to prevail. And if the law stays in effect while you're litigating, people will be irreparably harmed. And it's quite clear that women seeking reproductive care who just barely learn that they're pregnant at, 6 weeks yep. after, missing a period or something, that is irreparable harm for them to be denied access to their constitutional right to have to make that reproductive choice. But this court has refused to stay that law while the litigation is pending. So it's in essence signaling that it's not likely to uphold Roe.
Yep.
That it's likely to reverse Roe versus Wade. And in fact, that's precisely why Amy Coney Barrett was chosen by Leonard Leo.
Yep.
That's precisely why Brett Kavanaugh was chosen by Leonard Leo. That's precisely why Neil Gorsuch was chosen by Leonard Leo and put on the platter for Trump to pick from. So basically, choosing his menu to choose from
right.
a bunch of activists who were pre-chosen in order to reverse the rights of American women to their reproductive autonomy and to reverse this fundamental decision in Roe that acknowledged women have a right to control their own bodies and have a right to make decisions, particularly in the first trimester without state interference. And with, different a different weighting over that trimester, the three trimesters of pregnancy
yep.
in terms of how to balance the interests at stake. And so this is an assault on women's reproductive rights, including women who become pregnant from rape, but women who become pregnant who do not want to be forced into motherhood or parenthood
exactly.
or giving birth. And so it really is outrageous. I hope there's a huge reaction to this outrageous effort by this packed court to overturn women's rights. I hope that it really has significant consequences in the law and politically for this this affront to American women's equality.
Right. And you mentioned Justice Sotomayor, who was just brilliant. Let me play 25 seconds of her from from that hearing.
Will this institution survive the stench that this creates in the public perception that the Constitution and its reading are just political acts? If people actually believe that it's all political, how will we survive? How will the court survive?
And the question is not how, but will it survive? And I don't know that we do. Unless our leaders grow a pair and stand up and stop this madness, I really fear. I have, I don't know what the future is going to look like, but it's not going to look like what we've lived, what I've lived 62 years under.
I'm going to assume you mean grow a pair of breasts.
You're going to assume I mean what?
Grow a pair of breasts.
Yeah. Oh, that too. A pair of anything. Grow a spine and do yeah. something.
Yeah, I'm just teasing with you, Nicole, but I think as women, women are so strong and have such power that they don't realize. And I hope we see a new wave of activism like we saw after the election in 2016, where you have so many women coming out and marching to protect the rights of women and girls and future generations. And that we really, take a strong stand and really hold people accountable for this destructive decision that may come out, sometime next year that really undermines women's fundamental equality and women's autonomy and ability to choose their future.
Well, absolutely. But we also, that's of the utmost importance, as is saving what's left of this experiment we call democracy. Because I think we're teetering on the edge of a cliff right now, and it's very precarious. I don't know that we survive it. I really don't.
Well, I don't know that we would survive like a Caesar situation.
No.
I'm hopeful that there, even though there's, some, there's ongoing sort of depression or malaise. People just feel, this ongoing pandemic and.
Yeah.
The ongoing economic challenges. I hope that people, will, muster their sort of fortitude and not go back and not somehow allow this person and this effort by Trump to basically subvert our democracy to become, to have power again. Because I fear personally, I fear personally for what he and his followers would do if they had power again, given what we saw them do last time around. I think the American experiment in democracy is at risk. And, you know, I'm sorry that it's at risk by a particular person. And I, you know, personally, have great fear about Trump because he's a person of such poor character, such demonstrably poor character, and such deceit, such overt and continuous deceit that he's in my personal view, I'm not saying this organizationally,
right?
My personal view, he's absolutely unfit for public office, unfit for a position of public trust, and represents the worst of America and not its best.
That's so perfectly said, and it's a great spot to end on. Lisa Graves, we could keep talking for hours. Unfortunately, neither you nor I are in D.C. to get these people to do their jobs. Just a quick look back at the House, it looks like they're still talking. They're back talking again. I don't think they've taken up the vote again. The Democrats on the committee seem to be presenting their case again. It says live on C-SPAN, so I'm guessing that's what's happening right now. I don't have a producer, so I don't really know. But that's what it looks like. The Republicans are holding them up on this contempt vote on Mark Meadows, which is just par for the course for them. This is just more of their typical game playing. And it's just got to stop. We need to get back to the business of, they need to get back to the business of governing and making things better in this country. And unfortunately, we're headed in the wrong direction. Lisa Graves, you're great. Find Lisa at truenorthresearch.org. Check out the work they're doing there because you're doing some amazing work. And one of these days, we'll talk about one of the projects you're working on instead of my legal questions all the time.
Oh, no, I'm happy to come on and speak personally to you in my personal capacity, Nicole. And also, I really appreciate the plug for my organization's work. We have a lot of great work to come in 2022. And my team is busy at work trying to help get the truth out on some of these front groups that are, you know, distorting democracy. And hopefully people will go and visit that work. And thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you for coming. I can't tell you how much I appreciate your input and your expertise. Always appreciate it.
Oh, it's a joy to talk with you, Nicole. And thanks to your listeners for tuning in. It's always good to be on your show.
Oh, thank you. You too, Lisa. And if I don't talk to you, I probably won't. Have a very happy holidays, happy new year, and may 2022 finally be the year that turns around everything.
If it's for the better.
Oh, please.
And to you also.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks, Lisa. Okay. Bye-bye. All right. Bye. Lisa Graves, she just, as you can tell, is just awesome. She's just every bit as nice and generous with her time and information as she is brilliant. And I'm glad she's on our side. All right. Well, turning up the sound on the... this is that Republican guy again. You know what? I'm not Jim Banks of Indiana. Let's hear what they're saying.
Elected by Democrats to oversee federal law enforcement.
Okay, that's enough. I don't know what's going on. I guess I'll figure out, and we'll tell you tomorrow. I'll be back tomorrow. I did spend a few minutes on the phone this morning with Ryan Grimm of The Intercept. He's got a piece up today that I will link to on the blog at NicoleSandler.com/12-14-21, where I'll post today's show, about that new Medicare privatization program that, for whatever reason, Joe Biden is allowing to continue. It's called direct contracting. Go figure. It's like Medicare Advantage on steroids. It's the next worst thing. Not only does Ryan Grimm have a piece about it in today's at the Intercept right now, but Helene Olam, who is an editorial writer at the Washington Post, also has a piece about it in today's Washington Post. I will link to that one as well. In fact, I'll even post the text in case you're, you know, stuck in the paywall hell, so you can read it. It's important. So I did speak with Ryan Grimm about it today. Obviously, didn't have time to get to it. We'll do that tomorrow. And tomorrow also, Will Bunch of the Philadelphia Inquirer will join us. He's another one of those really great op-ed writers. He writes a column for the Inquirer that is really must-read. And today's is especially, all his stuff is good. But this one is about what we've learned from the tornado disaster in Kentucky and the other states. And Will Bunch is a smart guy with some interesting ideas. So tomorrow, well, we'll do that. In the meantime, I will leave you with the news and thank you, as always, for listening. All right. See you tomorrow, everyone. Bye. Here we go. There.
It's time for Nicole Sandler's What's News from NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
Mr. Chairman, I move that the committee favorably report to the House the committee's report on a resolution recommending that the House of Representatives fine Mark Randall Meadows in contempt of Congress for refusal to comply with a subpoena duly issued by the Select Committee to investigate the January 6th attack on the United States Capitol.
The House Select Committee investigating the January 6th Capitol attack voted Monday to recommend holding former White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows in criminal contempt of Congress for defying the panel's subpoena. The unanimous vote by the committee's 7 Democrats and 2 Republicans referred the matter to the full House, which is expected to vote on it as soon as today. Before they voted, the members of the committee, who've been doing most of their work behind closed doors, shared some new information gleaned from the more than 6,000 pages of documents that Mark Meadows had already handed over to the committee before he backed out of cooperating, claiming executive privilege. The evidence they presented indicated that Meadows was deeply involved in Trump's push to overturn President Biden's election victory. Representative Liz Cheney of Wyoming read texts from Fox News hosts and Donald Trump Jr., all urging Meadows to get the then president to speak out against the mob violence.
Multiple Fox News hosts knew the president needed to act immediately. They texted Mr. Meadows, and he has turned over those texts. Quote, Mark, the president needs to tell people in the Capitol to go home. This is hurting all of us. He is destroying his legacy, Laura Ingraham wrote. Please get him on TV, destroying everything you have accomplished, Brian Kilmeade texted. Quote, can he make a statement? Ask people to leave the Capitol, Sean Hannity urged. As the violence continued, one of the president's sons texted Mr. Meadows, quote, he's got to condemn this shit ASAP. The Capitol Police tweet is not enough, Donald Trump Jr. texted. Meadows responded, quote, I'm pushing it hard. I agree. Still, President Trump did not immediately act. Donald Trump Jr. texted again and again, urging action by the president. Quote, we need an Oval Office address. He has to lead now. It has gone too far and gotten out of hand, end quote. But hours passed without necessary action by the president.
Liz Cheney then saying, these text messages leave no doubt. The White House knew exactly what was happening here at the Capitol, and then suggested these messages served as evidence of Trump's, quote, supreme dereliction of duty. In a highly publicized phone call on Monday between Senator Joe Manchin, the most pivotal swing vote in the Senate, and President Biden, as Biden continues trying to get Manchin aboard with the rest of the party on this sweeping social safety net expansion known as the Build Back Better Act. But if you were hoping for resolution and a kumbaya moment, we're still going to have to wait. Manchin is raising serious concerns, as usual, now citing issues with the proposal's reliance on temporary programs. What? And renewing concerns over inflation. Great. More information coming to light about conditions at the Mayfield Consumer Products candle factory in Kentucky as bodies are removed from the wreckage. Survivors said supervisors threatened to fire them if they left their jobs early to try to avoid the tornado that later destroyed the plant. 8 people inside the factory were confirmed dead. One of them, Robert Daniel, was a deputy from nearby Graves County Jail who was supervising 7 inmates participating in a work release program. Reports say none of the 7 inmates were killed, though several were treated for minor injuries for helping to rescue some people trapped under the debris. One of the 7 used the chaos to simply walk away. He turned himself back into the police the following day. Former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin is due back in court on Wednesday, where he'll reportedly change his not guilty plea to guilty. for violating George Floyd's civil rights. Chauvin is already serving a 22-and-a-half-year sentence after being convicted of state murder and manslaughter. The federal civil rights trial for Chauvin and the three other former officers charged was set to begin in late February. All four had pleaded not guilty, but Chauvin is now scheduled to enter a new plea in the hearing on Wednesday. Stay tuned. Meanwhile, the trial of Kim Potter, another Minnesota police officer, this one charged in the shooting death of Dante Wright, began its second week of testimony on Monday. A pathologist on the stand said Potter's gunshot caused Wright's death. Potter claims she mistook her service revolver for her taser, which is what her lawyers say she intended to fire. In COVID news, the Supreme Court on Monday refused to block New York State's vaccine mandate covering workers in hospitals, nursing homes, hospices, and other medical facilities. Alito, Gorsuch, and Thomas dissented, with Gorsuch writing the state was violating religious freedom by declining to offer a religious exemption for abortion opponents who object to the current vaccines because they, quote, depend upon abortion-derived fetal cell lines in production or for testing. Oh, man. The High Court now has rejected requests to block state mandates in Indiana, Maine, and New York, giving states some leeway in fighting COVID-19 during this Delta variant surge. California, meanwhile, on Monday ordered a new statewide mask mandate for indoor spaces due to rising infections and concerns that the new, highly infectious Omicron variant could also fuel another surge. The mask requirement takes effect tomorrow. And we're learning more about the Omicron variant. A study released Tuesday by South Africa's largest health provider found that the newly emerged Omicron variant appears to cause less severe COVID-19 than the other strains, but is more resistant to vaccines. Lucky us. And finally, more than 500 gymnasts who were sexually abused by the former national team doctor Larry Nassar have agreed to a $380 million settlement with USA Gymnastics. The settlement was revealed Monday during a bankruptcy hearing for USA Gymnastics. Olympic gold medalists Simone Biles, Michaela Maroney, and Allie Raisman are among the women who qualify for compensation under the settlement, which is among the largest ever for a sexual abuse case. And that's just a bit of what's news for now. I'm Nicole Sandler. If you appreciate these reports and the Nicole Sandler Show, I hope you'll consider making a contribution. My work is fully listener-supported, and I can't do it without your help. Find out more at NicoleSandler.com, and please click on that donate button.